E.L. James, 50 Shades of Grey, an excerpt.
He moves so suddenly, so that his hand is cupping my sex, and one of his fingers sinks slowly into me. His other arm holds me firmly in place around my waist.
This is mine,
he whispers aggressively.
All mine, do you understand?
He eases his finger in and out of me as he gazes down at me, gauging my reaction, his eyes burning.
Yes, yours.
Abruptly he moves, doing several things at once, withdrawing his finger, leaving me wanting, unzipping his fly, and pushing me down on the couch so he's lying on top of me.
Hands on your head,
he commands through gritted teeth as he kneels up, forcing my legs wider.
We don't have long. This will be quick, and it's for me, not for you. Do you understand? No, don't come, or I will spank you.
Oh my god, that's just fucked up. That's so fucked up.
Someone published this.
How did someone allow this to be published?
This is a movie now.
Oh dear Jesus.
You may not know me, but I know you, and I'm aware how strange that sounds. You see, we cross paths.
What's up, guys, and welcome to The Fiction Fix, a Screen Junkie's guide to everything, your one-stop shop for film, TV, and everything in between. I'm Ben.
I'm Rohan.
And this episode, we're going to talk about 50 Shades of Grey.
More like 50 Shades of Terrible.
There's no shades of grey in this one. It's black and white, our opinions on this movie. It only came out today for
us. we saw it on the first day it came out.
Which is pretty exciting. So many people were telling me, why are you doing this? Like, why are you subjecting yourself to this? I've read the book, and it's not me. But other people said, I've read the book. I don't understand why you're going to the movie on the opening day. But We did it for you guys.
So yes, all for you guys.
I hope everything you're happy about you this. I hope you're happy with this. I hope you appreciate the effort that we go to. We put ourselves through traumas like this.
Before the movie started, I said to Ben, I was just like, please, Lord, protect my innocence, what is left of it. And, I mean, it didn't.
It didn't, in
just,
the slightest.
Just, I mean, more so in the sake of, like, I didn't think that that movies could be like that.
Yeah.
Let's give, minute.
Let's give a little bit of an overview before we start. So 50 Shades of Grey is based on a Twilight fanfiction by E.L. James, which is essentially about Anastasia Steele, who meets Christian Grey, who is a big shot young 27-year-old billionaire who is CEO to a massive company.
Yeah, just side note, have no idea what that company does.
Which I'm fine with. It's semi-Barney Stinson, but yeah, that's fine. And she engages in a sexual relationship with this man that is also contractual. They're in the middle of negotiations at this point. The entire movie is based around the negotiations and how these two work together, with Christian Grey being more sort of sexual and being more, you know, one-minded. And he has only one thing in the mind. Whereas Anastasia Steele is a little bit more of a romantic because she's an English lit major. And this movie, you can clearly tell, was a Twilight fanfiction.
Yeah, at no, one point. It was very, very obvious while watching the movie that the characterization, what little there was for the characters, was almost exactly the same, like, directly taken out of Twilight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you could pinpoint who was the Robert Pattinson character, who was the Kristen Stewart character, who was the Taylor Lautner character. Yeah. Like, it was very obvious.
Who, just side note, the Taylor Lautner character wasn't in there for very long.
No, it was like 5 minutes max.
Of conflict. He thought it would go somewhere in the end, but it really didn't. It kind of just disappeared. I don't want to give too much away, but then again, I think everyone really knows what the backstory is.
Yeah.
Everyone knows what to expect when coming into it, and I think that's what the movie relied upon.
Yeah.
Is because a lot of the things that they say in the movie are a little, like, cheeky when they lead up to the whole BDSM stuff.
Yeah,
they're kind of, like, foreshadowing it a bit, but not in a way that's kind of mysterious, because they know that we know what it's about.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is really tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
And that's what they're writing off. And I feel like the director and the screenwriter were kind of jumping at the opportunity to make a feature film with such a big budget.
Mm.
And they kind of didn't stop to realize that what they were making was rubbish.
Yeah. I mean, one thing we were talking about was just making the best of a bad situation. And I feel like what they were working with wasn't the best to start out with.
No, that's right. I mean, we gave an excerpt of one of the parts of the book in the intro to the podcast.
That was very hard to read.
Oh my God. we had to scour through a whole bunch of quotes to find the perfect one for the intro. And we found one. But my God, did it take us a while to get there. there.
So long.
So in this movie, I looked at my watch probably about 3,000 times.
Yeah. I never check my phone during movies, but I mean,
my God.
I just could not do it.
I think we mentioned to ourselves in the first 5 minutes, my God, I want to leave in this movie.
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, there were a lot of things that were bad about it. And yes, I know that there are a lot of middle-aged women around the world who may disagree with me who actually really like it. And these are the same people who made E.L. James a billionaire from writing Twilight fan fiction. But the point is that there are a whole lot of things in that movie that were just really lacking for me. Mm. And it was, there were a whole lot of warning lights at the beginning of the movie that made me know that this wasn't going to be great.
I mean, for starters, we'll just start off with the soundtrack.
Yeah, okay, that's good. Yeah, we'll start off with the positives. The soundtrack to that movie was great.
The soundtrack was awesome. Done by Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
We have the rendition of Crazy in Love, which Rohan kept whispering to me every time it came on. All these different renditions of it.
The thing is, Danny Elfman did the score, but the score is very reminiscent of the new cover they've done of the new arrangement they've done of Crazy in Love.
Yeah.
And so if you watch the movie, you can notice in a lot of scenes where there's a little bit of piano music and the strings come in. If you listen carefully, it's all the chords for Crazy in Love.
I mean, it's not new, that sort of concept. I mean, you have a few other movies. Some of them have done the neighborhood songs throughout the films in different renditions. And that's fine, but you just gotta... The neighborhood is a band, whereas Crazy in Love is one song.
Yeah.
And you gotta try and figure out different ways to make it fresh every time it's on. And Danny Elfman does fine with it. He's good. The soundtrack is pretty cool.
Yeah. I was really happy. I mean, as we walked out of the cinema, Ben said to me, you know, that soundtrack was great. And the woman in front of us turned around and was like, yeah, it was the best part of the movie.
The only
good part of the movie. I was like, yeah, pretty much.
I thought the stark difference in the movie for me was between the soundtrack and something that was equally as integral, if not more so, which was the dialogue.
Yeah,
the screenplay was absolute trash.
Yes, I mean, I would not disagree with you at all on any front there.
I mean, both the story itself and the dialogue were equally as awful. Yeah,
well, I mean, we'll get into plot later because it was practically non-existent.
Yeah, exactly.
The dialogue in that movie was reminiscent of one of those, like, Lifetime TV movies, like the type that they show on Channel 7 at midday.
Absolutely, yeah.
It was just really trashy. And yeah, the movie ended up becoming more cinematic towards the end, but when the characters were starting to talk to each other at the beginning, it played out in a very weird way.
It was awkward.
Yeah, and unbelievable.
I'll say that the movie starts off... It seemed like it was filmed in chronological order.
Yeah.
At the beginning, they were kind of still getting their feet, still not sure what they were doing with the movie, where it was going to go. By the middle, they were kind of like, yeah, I think we know where we're going. Then at the end, they're like, okay, let's kind of wrap it up now. Let's get it done. And I felt like the cast and the crew behind the scenes kind of had the same feeling as us.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And it's obvious in the film.
It is. I mean, in the first third slash half of the film, all the editing, all the dialogue was just really awkwardly done.
Yeah.
A lot of the edits were cut very weirdly.
They were. Helicopter scene?
The helicopter scene was weird.
Unnecessary to, like, cuts.
Yeah, because I was talking to Rohan as soon as the helicopter scene came on, and this isn't spoiling anything, but you'd have one angle with the camera, and then it immediately cut to another angle that was just completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
They could have done so much more with the cinematography of the film. They could have used that, because the camera is a beast of its own.
Yeah.
And a lot of the best directors, like David Fincher, like Spielberg, they can use the camera to their advantage to become its own character.
Yeah.
Fincher has like an omnipresent
experience with the camera. If anybody does this in, you know, specifically, if anybody uses the character to create a character, if anyone uses the camera to create a character in and of itself, it's Wes Anderson.
Oh yeah, exactly. That's
uses
true.
The character in such a quirky way that you almost feel that it is a character in and of itself. But the thing is, one thing that I definitely, we said this during the film, one thing that I definitely noted was that they wanted to show off the fact that they had a massive budget.
Mm.
And so one thing they did was they used a whole lot of luxury products, a whole lot of, you know, very fancy apartments, amazing cars.
Can we just point out that Apple absolutely sponsored this
100%.
Entire movie. It was very clear how many Apple products there were and who was using them.
Yeah.
I mean, Christian Grey, every single technological product he had was Apple.
And the first thing I noticed, actually, was that when Anastasia walks into the office, you know, Christian Grey's office at the beginning of the film.
He's got a MacBook.
Yeah, he's got a MacBook Pro sitting on that desk. First thing I noticed.
And they always reference the iPhone. They've got iMessage up there. Then he gives what's a face a MacBook.
Like, what's a face?
Become part of my world.
Oh my god.
It's so weird.
But yeah, all they wanted to do was show off their budget.
Yeah.
Because they had this scene, and again, not spoiling anything because there is absolutely nothing to spoil.
Yeah, there really isn't. Everything,
because there is no plot. There are no twists or anything.
Every single thing that you expect to happen in this movie happens.
Yeah. The one shot that was actually a really cool shot, which was the glider scene.
Yeah.
Where he takes her on a glider. Cool shots. And they really showcase how much of a budget they have. They use cool lighting and the aerial shots were really cool. But it didn't need to happen. It added nothing to the plot.
I did absolutely nothing to that movie for that movie.
The plot,
apart from make it longer.
Exactly. The movie could be explained or described as stale and stagnant.
Yeah.
They're probably the words I would use to describe it.
I like the alliteration. It sounds so much better than anything I've heard in the last 4 hours. So I feel like this is good. We're making progress.
Maybe we should get started on the screenplay for the second one.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I mean,
it'll make a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, well, this movie really was a cash grab. I mean, there are two more books in this trilogy, which is ridiculous because there wasn't even a plot in the first one. How could there be enough to stretch it over two more books? But there's no doubt in my mind that they'll probably make two more books.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people criticize The Hobbit for being three movies for one book.
I criticize but, 50 Shades of Grey for being one movie in general, but
yeah, exactly. At least in each of the Hobbit movies, they had a sort of orientation and a climax and a resolution. Even though there was an overarching arc, each movie had its own little plot points. This movie was absolutely incredible because it was orientation.
Yeah.
And it felt like it was leading to something, but you weren't sure where. So in the end, it was nothing. There was nothing that it was leading up to.
It was one of those movies that could have been good because I am generally a fan of movies that have very simple plots but do a lot with the characters.
Yeah.
But the thing is, and characterization was just one of the biggest flaws this movie had, where it was a character piece, like Mad Men is a character piece, but the problem is, I felt literally nothing for those characters.
Absolutely.
Because they were all completely unbelievable.
And I mean, the actors, well, the main actors were fine in their jobs.
Yeah.
I mean,
like, Dakota Johnson was fine. Jamie Dornan, you know, brought something to that character.
He was probably the better of the actors.
Yeah. I mean, he's probably the more seasoned one.
I mean, yeah,
he's been
probably
in a couple of things.
Well, so is Dakota Johnson, I guess.
Yeah,
but
true.
She was okay.
Yeah.
But just the supporting cast were also not that great.
No. I mean, surprise cameo from Rita Ora. That was unexpected.
She kind of came out of nowhere and did nothing for the film.
I mean, she was there for about less than the Taylor Lautner character.
Well, I mean, most of the supporting cast, except for maybe two, were only in about one or two scenes each.
Yeah, true.
So they absolutely had nothing. They relied on the characterization of the main characters, which was flawed to begin with.
Mm. Definitely. I think that this movie just really, it aimed to suck you in terms of, like, you relating to those characters. So people are supposed to be able to relate to this, to Dakota Johnson's character, Anastasia, this, like, innocent, kind of, like, naive, unworldly, you know, girl who's just leaving university and going into the real world. And then people are also supposed to relate to Jamie Dornan's character, Christian Grey, who is this kind of like darker, more worldly kind of seasoned guy who understands more about the harshness of the world.
Well, I think people are supposed to see him as sort of a Mr. Darcy serious, dark, brooding character.
Well, more brooding than Mr. Darcy.
Well,
at least
yeah,
Mr. Darcy turns out to be nice at the end, guys. Spoiler alert, but I mean, you've had 200 years to read the book. I think that one thing that they just really needed to do was make those characters more believable, and the dialogue is generally the platform in which they do it. And I'm like, I think of myself as the king of awkward, right?
Yeah.
I am very familiar with awkward situations. And even these awkward situations, like, Wes Anderson knows how to pin them, right?
Yeah.
But here, Sam Taylor Johnson just really didn't understand exactly what was involved.
Yeah, because it's not just the screenwriter's fault.
You can't
place all the blame on her.
No.
It's the way it's shot, it's the way it's edited, it's everything mixed together. It's an amalgamation, which is why it's such a melting pot.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely.
And 50 Shades of Grey is just an amalgamation of everything that makes a bad film.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, it has sparks of greatness in there with Danny Elfman. I mean, I won't say greatness, but sparks of light.
Sparks of better than the rest of the movie-ness. Yeah,
exactly. But, I mean, in terms of an entire movie, how it comes together, it just doesn't mesh
at
all. And the creative direction that Sam Taylor Johnson took just didn't complement the plot at all. I mean, there definitely. Was no plot.
Yeah. When you make a movie entirely, and it was something like over an hour and 40.
It was a long movie.
Yeah.
For what the plot was, where it, you could have wrapped it up in a, you know, yes. a 10-minute short film on YouTube.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Well, the thing is, if you have this kind of will-they-won't-they situation as the basis for the entire movie, with literally nothing else happening around, like, I think that that's something that you really need to kind of think about, because are people really going to be that invested in seeing a will-they-won't-they movie for an hour and 45 minutes?
I mean, you've got to have other things in there. You've got to have other elements to the plot.
The reason will-they-won't-they stories work so well is they generally work in TV when you have 22 episodes and it's a subplot to the greater story arc of the show. Here, there was literally no plot. The entire plot was will-they-won't-they, and the thing is, nobody cares.
Yeah.
Especially with such bad characterization. It just does not add anything.
The best films have A, B, C plots.
Yeah.
Or they have a main plot with layers to it. This movie only had one plot, only had an A plot. There were no B, no C. And the A plot was just simplistic.
Yeah.
And it was not well thought out.
Yeah, definitely. I just think that they had a bit of potential for this movie. Like, it's not like this movie had literally zero potential at the off-put.
It's not like our expectations were low for this film, because they had a big budget.
Yeah, I thought it would be, like, okay. Like, I thought it would be average.
I thought they'd rectify the mistakes in the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. No,
but, I mean, seemingly with the dialogue, they've tried their best.
Yeah.
Maybe. We hope they've tried their best, otherwise it's pretty disappointing.
Yeah.
They've tried their best and they've come out with this really awkward, awkward movie. It's weird.
It's weird. It's not even awkward, because awkward can sometimes be kind of endearing.
You can do quirky awkward.
Yeah.
Like, Wes Anderson, you can do, Woody Allen does quirky
awkward.
Woody
Allen does great, like Annie Hall is one of the greatest quirky films of all time.
Exactly, but this film is just unintentionally awkward. To the point where it's uncomfortable for me.
Oh, yeah, no, there were many times in this film where I felt uncomfortable, and it wasn't just during the, like, explicit BDSM sex scenes.
I mean, we'll get to the BDSM sex scenes, but as a movie on its own,
it was just weird and uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, the BDSM itself was not as uncomfortable for me as the rest of the film when the characters were talking.
Yeah,
that doesn't show it doesn't show much about me, trust me. It's just, I think that when the characters weren't talking, it works much better.
Yeah.
And it's because of the stupid dialogue that was written.
Also, can I just say, I didn't feel like there was any chemistry between Jamie Dornan and Dakota Johnson.
No, that's because Jamie Dornan's character was very cold.
And yeah.
They tried to give an insight into his character to kind of make us relate to him a bit more, but because we didn't relate to them at all, we couldn't see them working well together.
But even, like, because generally you can feel that kind of tension between the characters, and what some of the best, like, on-screen relationships do, I think one that does it really well is Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone in the first remake Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
Not the second. Like, I just, big, big, like, condition there. But I think
Speaking of, he's done now, so.
Yeah, oh, that's really sad. That's a side note, really hope they bring Donald Glover in for Spider-Man. But anyway.
Maybe.
Oh, Marvel. Oh, we'll have another podcast on this.
Yeah.
But I really think that the best on-screen couples have very tangible chemistry. It's very obvious that they are both into each other. And Christian Grey is into Anastasia. Like, it's part of the plot, whatever the plot is. But I didn't feel it between those two characters at all. But and I mean, despite the fact that there's literally 20 minutes of sex scenes in this movie.
But I mean, I think it comes back down to the dialogue.
Yeah.
So the dialogue between the characters is awkward.
Yeah.
Then we're going to find their relationship itself awkward and we won't see any spark or chemistry there.
Yeah.
It's got to be realistic. It's got to be relatable. And the dialogue is so, so important. That's why screenplays and screenwriters are so underrated.
Yeah.
That's why they're so undervalued, I should say.
Underappreciated.
Underappreciated. And they're so integral to the story.
Absolutely.
They're so integral to a movie.
Absolutely.
And in this film, it was shown just exactly why you need a good story writer and a good screenwriter.
Yeah.
It's so important.
Otherwise, people are going to switch off. And I mean,
which we did.
There were several points in that movie where I was like, if I wasn't reviewing this, I would definitely walk out.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, we paid like $23 to see this movie.
It's an expensive movie. It was a big screen.
Extreme screen, So I feel like just money not really worth it, but then also it's kind of worth it because the movie was so terrible that I enjoyed making fun of it.
Yeah. And I mean, we're releasing a podcast like literally hours.
Yeah, exactly.
After, so.
Hours.
So this is fresh off the press.
Fresh off the press.
Now, can we talk about the BDSM thing? Because there's been a lot of controversy over it.
We're not going to touch on it a lot
because we don't want to get too much into the sociological.
Yeah, or the political side of things.
We're going to focus mostly on the context of the movie. The way the characters do it, the way that it's written, the way it's portrayed to us. We're not going to make commentary on that, you know.
What it actually is. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know, we're against domestic abuse, but we don't want to get too much into that because where we stand is pretty, you know, it's common with most people.
And then both of us work within a legal framework as well. So, like, we were talking about this before the movie started because we both just done criminal law last year, and we've both kind of looked at the legal framework that's behind this, and it's kind of very interesting, but we all have our own opinions on it.
Yeah, yeah.
So what we want to do is get into what actually happened in the movie, because we went into this movie, both of us. I mean, did you have really any idea of what the movie was about before you went in?
Apart from the BDSM stuff? Yeah. No,
same. Like, I'd never read the books. I'd only, like, seen a video of George Takei doing
a piss take.
Yeah, pretty much. George Takei reading books, and then at the end of every, you know, naughty bit, he would be like, oh my. But, so I walked in not really knowing exactly what to expect. I just knew that there would be sex scenes, because I'd read an article that said 20 minutes worth of sex scenes in this movie. And I was like, okay, well, that's going to be interesting.
I mean, not that we're arguing.
No, true. But then I think that it was interesting in the movie. Definitely those scenes were a little bit confronting to watch. There was a woman sitting on the other side of the aisle to me, but on my left, and she, every time something would happen in the scene, you know, Anastasia would get whipped or something like that, and she would just go, like, shrink back in her seat.
But, I mean, a lot of people have opinions on this, very strong opinions, about this movie glorifying domestic abuse.
Yeah.
In the context of the movie, let's, you know, make that perfectly clear.
Yeah.
I don't think in this movie it glorifies it at all.
Because, I don't think so either.
Because for two reasons. One, they show genuinely that Christian Grey, what he's doing is not right.
Yeah.
And that it's not normal. And that they should desire a more romantic relationship. And two, actually three things. Two, they show that it's consensual.
Yes.
And it's entirely consensual, and it would not be happening if it weren't consensual.
They put a very massive emphasis on consent. It's pretty much the entire plot.
Yeah, exactly. And thirdly, he's not the only one asserting power over her. She very clearly throughout the film has very strong moments where she asserts dominant power over him.
Definitely.
So it's a dynamic there.
Yeah.
And you can't simply say black and white
that
it's glorifying domestic abuse, because yes, there are 50 shades of grey between that. You know, there are so many different layers there.
Yeah.
And I personally don't think it is because of those reasons.
No, I definitely don't think that it glorifies domestic abuse. I think that the movie takes a very different path, and I think that anybody who really thinks that it might be reading into it a little bit too much.
I mean, we haven't read the book, so we can't speak for the book. I mean, the book might have. We don't know. That's what a lot of people are going off, because the movie only came out today.
But I definitely think that the movie doesn't really portray BDSM in a good light at all.
No, it doesn't.
I think that, and that's one of the controversies that a lot of people have been kicking up a fuss about now the movie's been released, is that, you know, a lot of people are saying that it doesn't portray BDSM in the way that it really should be portrayed. And I think that this definitely portrays it with a negative stigma. I mean, like, not to say that, you know, some people are into that, some people aren't.
Oh, no, absolutely.
But I think that, you know, if that is what you like, the movie does not portray you in a good light, which is, you know, kind of sad for the people who are actually into that. But, like,
I mean, it recognizes that it is a thing, and people do enjoy it, but it doesn't glorify it when it's not consensual or when it's actually hurting someone. Because because in the movie, there's this one scene right at the end, again, not spoiling anything,
because there's nothing to spoil.
Exactly. Where there's a kind of brutal-esque scene. It's not graphic.
It was a little bit confronting, though.
Confronting, but it wasn't graphic.
No. That was probably the best camera angle that they used.
Probably.
They realized, hey, looking at someone from below actually has an effect. And they're like, hey, let's look at power trip. But I think that, that scene was like...
Yeah, in that scene, they kind of... It was consensual, but they showed it to be... They didn't glorify it at all, but they showed that it was wrong and it was having a damaging effect on them.
Yeah, yeah. And definitely for them particularly, but in that relationship, that was really never going to work.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think that if the characters had any characterization at all, it was pretty much there.
Yeah, exactly. So in this film, I don't think the controversy that's surrounding it is necessarily grounded in absolute fact.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are, you know, there are points in there that people do have that are valid. But in this film, for me, I didn't find any sort of glorification that they, you know, validated this sort of controversy.
I didn't think that either. And I feel like this movie has a lot to kind of answer for in terms of what it says it was going to achieve versus what it actually did. And, I mean, glorifying domestic abuse, it definitely didn't do that. Portraying BDSM in a positive light, I mean, it definitely didn't do that. I think when we look at female empowerment in this movie, sexual liberation is definitely not something that I would say this movie portrays in a good way. And then I also don't think, I mean, it does in some one sense, but it also doesn't in another sense.
It kind of shows both sides of the argument, yeah. Yes. Both sides of the coin, in having this girl who is being sexually liberated of her own choice.
Yeah.
And showing that how that's good that she's doing that. She's kind of breaking out of her own comfort zone. But then she hits a point that which is her limit, and it shows that yes, everyone can have a limit, and that's fine, and people should have a limit, I guess, because if you keep going too far, then you might hurt someone.
I think the other thing that this movie kind of needs to answer for is this idea of feminine empowerment, because I feel like for a movie that seems to be, you know, saying, hey, you know, we should be talking about, you know, women's sex lives as well very openly in the media, and that we should be looking at, you know, what sex can do to empower women, it really didn't portray that in the best light. Like, especially at the beginning, where Anastasia is this very meek, mild, really unbelievably timid character who is being almost psychologically manipulated by Christian Grey. And one thing that I've read a lot while, you know, leading up to this movie is just the idea that, I mean, that Anastasia is being manipulated entirely throughout the entire movie.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think the one thing the movie really did was show this idea of manipulation. And it really made me uncomfortable to watch her being manipulated so much.
It wasn't just her, though. She was manipulating him at points.
At points, but I think
but
that
for the
very,
most
yeah,
part.
I think that for the majority of the movie, it was her being the victim.
Yeah.
And I think that that was just really weird for a movie that is supposed to be, you're saying like, hey, you know, we need to make sure that women are talking about these specific things, when it's not really doing
exactly.
that at all.
And this is a separate discussion to the domestic abuse.
Yeah, yeah.
This is entirely separate, because female empowerment and domestic abuse are entirely different arguments. For me, the female empowerment in this film, you can see moments where, yes, it was glorified, and which is great, where you can see this girl kind of stand up for herself, where she used to be timid, and which is part of her nature, not necessarily because of the manipulation, but after having learned that you can manipulate people, she kind of stepped up and she kind of became her own person.
She definitely is kind of empowered, just stronger by the end of the movie, very obviously so. But then again, I feel like in an ideal world, she should be raised into that, and she should grow into it, as opposed to being pushed into it.
That's right.
And she was definitely pushed into it emotionally. And you guys will know in the climactic scene of the film, she's really, really just kind of forced into that role. She has to stand up for herself. Otherwise, psychological manipulation, the circle of manipulation, is just going to keep on going.
Which, yeah, again, this film and that particular point of the film is just uncomfortable for us to watch.
Yeah.
As people who are, you know, pretty liberal and very, very strongly for female empowerment and rights and everything like that.
Yeah, exactly. I just felt like this movie was... It did make me very uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
And I feel like that could have been a good thing, but it really wasn't in this case.
No, it wasn't. I feel like, the film kind of set itself up to be something that it just didn't achieve on any level.
Yeah, especially when this main character is supposed to be this kind of charming, attractive, kind of seductive guy. When
he's just a narcissist.
Yeah, he turns out to be a textbook narcissist, and you can see it. Like, it's not even something that is revealed suddenly. Like, it's not something they originally portray him as this charming guy, and then all of a sudden he turns up. Like, it's very clear from the first moment you see him that he is a textbook narcissist.
Which is fine if you can do it well, but unfortunately the characterization was just very one-dimensional.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And transparent the entire way through.
And, I mean, the entire film was Twilight. Like, I just could not say, like, oh yeah, no, Dakota Johnson was Christian Stewart and Jamie Dornan was Robert Pattinson. Like, it just would not leave my mind.
Yeah.
Which is a big, big, you know, flaw in the movie if the entire time I'm just relating it to the movie that it's based on.
Exactly. And as a movie as a whole, if we're going to wrap it up, Rohan, what would you give 50 Shades of Grey out of 5?
Well, I mean, I really like the soundtrack. That's probably the redeeming quality. And, I mean, there was one scene with a luxury car where I was just kind of like, wow, look at that car. So, I guess I'm going to give it maybe 1 out of 5.
1 out of 5. Nice. I'm going to just preface by saying the IMDb score, after literally only a few hours of it being released, is 3.4 out of 10.
So, yeah. Which is crazy. Promising. So promising.
For myself, I'm going to rate 50 Shades of Grey a 1.3 out of 5.
That's because we love our bullet points. We love our decimal points.
We love our decimals. Oh my God.
I love my bullet points. All right, guys, that wraps up the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us for our first episode without Martin.
Well, I mean, we've had a few episodes in the past without Martin.
Yeah, the first official one. Yeah, because he's not in the city anymore.
It's so sad. We get a Snapchat from him before. We're just kind of like, oh.
He's like, he's not here. But yeah, no, it's going to be a lot more like this with just Ben and I. So I hope you guys enjoyed the format of today.
Yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed the shorter podcast. We're trying to keep it a little bit more succinct so you can enjoy it on your ride home.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than a few trips back and forth.
Yes. And hopefully now that we're recording a couple of more shorter podcasts, we can release more within the month.
Yeah,
as well.
Exactly. Let us know what you guys want us to review next or have discussions on.
Yeah, leave us some comments on Facebook, send us a message, send us an email, you know, feel free. All right, guys, that wraps up this episode. Join us next time when we talk about a massive deal that went through. Or our favorite web-slinger just got signed for a massive deal to be a part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Whoa, my God.
It's going to be amazing.
It's so exciting. I mean, in the next podcast, we're going to talk about, you know, different theories about what's going to happen, how Marvel and Sony are going to handle it, because Sony's still technically own the rights, but yeah. Marvel has so much control at the moment, so much power, and it's incredible. And I'm getting power hungry just listening
Me
to
too.
It.
Me too. It's literally all of my Christmas so come at once. Anybody who's read the comics, especially Ultimate Spider-Man, will know that there are so many things that they can do with this storyline, and this has not only significance in terms of making an actual movie, but in terms of expanding the Marvel Universe as well, and so we're really excited to talk about it next time.
And I mean, this massive deal between two massive corporations has so many ramifications and so many consequences in the positive light.
Exactly.
For Hollywood and the film industry in general. So yeah. Listen to our next podcast to hear more about that.
In the meantime, make sure you like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fictionfixofficial.
Check out our YouTube page at The Fiction Fix Official, where you can find out exactly how it went down when we booked our tickets to 50 Shades of Grey awkwardly over the phone, because
yes.
That was the modern telecommunications device that we decided to go with.
We took a trip down memory road all the way back to the 90s and decided it would be more personable if we'd called up the cinema.
And that worked out well when we decided to use spontaneous accents.
Yes, very, very spontaneous.
Share us with your friends. Thanks for listening, guys. Thank you for Toussaint Morrison for all his music again.
You guys can find me on Twitter with the handle at Rohan Hora.
You can find me on Instagram with the handle at Ben Chapel. And until next time, we'll make your podcast you can't refuse.
It looks like this, but I was with the ex getting good night sex. She was standing at the ledge singing come fly with. Tempting. She pitched a fair case, but I opted out and beat it to the bottom. Took the staircase, ran across the park till the sun went dark. Ran until I couldn't remember where the chapter starts. Reasons get lost, the story gets blurry. Misery's on patrol like cops lurking. They wanna take our party by the curtains and turn it into warm beer, cold women and no mercy. Have no fear, I'm in it to go dirty. I got the soul of 1,000 ghost riders on Sturgis. She came back for friendship, the best revenge. I took the bait in good faith. Let's pretend you're worth every bit of self-respect that's left. Kiss, kiss, bang. I made a say. Ooh.